This is the World Retail Podcast, the premier platform for global retail leaders, where vision meets insight and innovation takes center stage. From AI to embedded finance, leadership to the ever-evolving consumer, we bring you the voices shaping the future of retail. World Retail Podcast, your front row seat to retail's next chapter.
Hello and welcome to the World Retail Podcast. My name is Ian McGarrigle and I'm the founder and chair of the World Retail Congress. This episode is part of our special series of podcasts produced in partnership with the global retail team at Deloitte. This series is focused on one of the most important drivers of retail success, and that is the customer. Over six episodes, we will bring you high-level interviews with some top retail leaders to learn more about how they are focused on the customer. We wanted to bring you this special bonus episode in the series because there can be few more customer-focused businesses in the world than IKEA. And we had the opportunity to interview one of the world's leading consumer insight experts, Inter IKEA's global head of insights, Joel Renkema. I was joined for this special interview by Adhild Hop, retail market lead North-South Europe and consumer consulting lead for the Netherlands at Deloitte. I very much hope you enjoy this episode with Adhild and I in conversation with Joel Renkema. So, hi, Adhild. Good to see you again. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Thrilled to be here.
Good. Yeah, thanks for joining us. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you, Joel, to the World Retail Podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me for a little bit of time.
Yeah. So, Joel, just to kick us off, would love to know, in terms of your career, what attracted you to retail? How long have you been at IKEA? And maybe you could just tell us a little bit more about your role as head of insights at IKEA.
Yeah, perfect. Joel, I've been at IKEA for about 4 years now, but I'm an FMCG born baby over the time, right? So originally from Australia, starting out at Procter & Gamble, working in different parts of the world for different businesses, and then Reckitt Benckiser, and then into IKEA about 4 years ago. So getting the privilege of seeing different businesses in different parts of the world and different ways of operating. Joined IKEA 4 years ago because it's just a really interesting business, right? It's a different from FMCG, right? It's a franchise, all franchisees set up, home furnishing retailer. It's not a public FMCG company. So just learning about different ways of operating in different contexts. And, you know, I think all of us as people and as consumers have an IKEA story. I can't meet anybody and introduce myself without them telling me their IKEA shopping experience. So I think it's something that we all relate to as a brand and as an experience as well. And then at IKEA, as you said a second ago, I joined in getting the joy and privilege to run insights for Inter IKEA. Just so people know, IKEA is a franchise business across. Inter IKEA is the franchisor that operates all of it across the world. So I get to do insights there, running from supply all the way through to retail, brand, media, product innovation, and everything across the value chain.
That's great. Great you could join us. So over to you, Adhild.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, and so hopefully everyone who sees this can kind of understand why Ian and I were as excited as we are about having Joel joining us today. Joel, maybe let's start on the kind of the consumer more widely. And I think we all, those of us who have been in CPG and retail, we know that, you know, a large part of what makes retail work was this assumption of like mass, right? The assumption that, you know, a consumer is all part of a family with a husband and a wife and 2.2 children and a station wagon and a white picket fence, et cetera. And that if you had enough scale, your retail model could be quite a viable P&L. As the Deloitte research from earlier this year highlighted, that idea of mass and all consumers being equal is really kind of watering down quite quickly, and you end up with all these little micro segments. Can you share a little bit about how you within IKEA see that shift? Do you recognize this shift from mass to micro and yeah, let's start with what you observe.
Yeah. Look, definitely, right? I think even if we look at the last couple of years or expand it back the last 40 to 50 years, you see a change over time. I think as people and as consumers, not even as business people, we see it in our own lives, in people that we interact with, and in our context as well, is what is normal, right? I think that definition of normal is rapidly evolving and has been rapidly evolving, right? We can't say it's going to change because it has changed in a way. So for us, we definitely look at it. We're a home furnishing business, right? We're here to create a better everyday life for the many people and at home, right? That's what we do. So for us, the home construct, what defines a family, how we live as people heavily influences what we do as a business as well and how we go through. Now, I think the question, though, is what really determines what people do differently and how people live differently? Because if you remember, there was a little while ago, there was this whole thing of, you know, taken maybe 10, 15 years ago, right? Attitudinal segmentation everywhere. And every company had an attitudinal segmentation with comfort seekers and nature lovers and all this kind of stuff, right? And we tried to, like, put people into boxes. Mm-hmm. And then I think as an industry, we learned over time, you can't put people in a box, right? And even though I'm, you know, a middle-aged male, I might have the same needs as an elderly female, right? And so, yes, there's an element of I have a demographic difference and my construct is different, but it's more around what are those aspects across, what are the needs that are similar or different, and then how do you be relevant to somebody, mm-hmm. but drive scale through that as well. And it's finding that balance in there as a sweet spot makes it powerful.
And so this idea of the family composition being a really important part for life at home, what are some of the things that you have seen happen? So we've clearly seen kind of the increasing role of the female, declining marriage rates, declining birth rates, et cetera. Mm. Are those the things that are fundamentally changing consumption patterns that you're seeing, or is it something else?
Look, I think firstly, it's as I said, we're based on how you construct a home, right? So it's really about what of those things impact how you would construct a home in there. If you're living by yourself versus living with three children, then your needs for home furnishing radically change, right, in there as well. So yes, you do definitely see shifts in there as well. You know, shifts in people renting versus owning. I think there's huge statistics if you look at the last 20 years or so in places like the UK where home ownership's dropped significantly, right? How you behave when you rent versus how you behave when you own has an impact on what you do as well, right? And what furniture you have, how you design the place, how you make it feel like home for yourself as well. So for sure, they definitely impact it. Some of the factors a little bit less, some of the factors a little bit more. And then I think secondly, it's also a matter of then how do you engage? Right, if we think about media 20, 30 years ago, you could put a 30-second TV ad with a mom and a husband, a white picket fence and three kids and go, boom, here's your home, look at your needs and therefore what you have. It's static, you run that through the year and you're done, right? Your cost efficiency is much better in there. Now the thing is, but that person doesn't look like me. And so how do I engage with them? But then the challenge is look like me. You have 100 different types of look like me, right? Yeah. Because of the diversity of how we are as a society now as well. And that obviously causes fragmentation, right, in how you operate. So I think it has implication through the innovation that you create, but also the way that you engage, because you want to build a relationship, but you need to know who you're building a relationship with versus vice versa as well.
Really fascinating. And so there's a bunch of themes in there, which I think we can touch on later. One around this marketing and engagement piece. Mm-hmm. Just jumping back to the point that you made around rent versus buy and the different kind of consumption patterns there. Do you see different behaviors or different baskets between those types of consumers? Like, do I buy different furniture if I rent versus if I've bought a home, do you think?
It's mostly the mindset that evolves, right? Because renting, it's very much you have a contract for a year or 2 years and I'm there. And I don't know if I'm going to stay here for 2 or 3 years or not. So do I buy a big piece of furniture that I can move or I cannot move?
Yeah.
Has an impact as well, right? Am I going to install a wardrobe in a house that I'm not going to live in for 2 years? Maybe not, right?
Yeah.
If it's a little bit temporary as well, do I spend more money on more aspects of the house, right? Where is that value equation that's there? At the same time, you still have the fundamental core need of it's my home and I want a place where I belong. And even if it's for like 3 months, I want to belong, right? And yeah. I don't know, even as an expat living in different countries, it's like the biggest thing is you can't feel like you live in a suitcase. Even if you're there for 3 months on an assignment or 12 months on an assignment or whatever
it may be,
it has to feel like home.
Yeah.
So you have to get your clothes out of the suitcase and put them in the cupboard because then you start feeling like home, right?
Yeah.
You have to start putting pictures on the wall because then home is where the family is, right? So yes, it has an aspect for sure, but it's more around no matter who you are, the house is the home, and how do you help to create that sense of belonging in there as well, especially in this transitionary world that we live into.
Yeah. And so one of the themes that we touched on when we were kind of chatting before this conversation is the rise of the single-person household. My sense is that that's in particular also, well, just in Western economies, but also in emerging economies.
Yeah.
Can you shed a bit of light on again, how the single-person household is different to the multi-person household and how they buy differently?
Yeah. Well, it depends on what stage you are, right?
Okay.
Because you also have single-person household, as in, like, I'm young and I'm moving out, I'm going to college and I'm renting. It's a single-person household. Then you have a single household where you have, you know, with rising divorce rates, right? Then you see it's like I'm a single household, or I'm a single parent with kids as well, that changes. Or I'm a single household because I'm a widow and elderly and I live alone, right? Those three basic examples, right, have an impact on how you want to live within that home and how you want to buy within that home as well. So yes, it's a living alone, but also it's all the other constructs around your situation. And I guess we look at it a bit more in terms of like, life stage, situation, context, because then it's more, what's that context in which you're in, and therefore how do you behave in that as well? You know, when you go and do basic qualitative research, like I did a couple of weeks ago in the States, and you meet a 75-year-old single male living by himself, and you say, what home furnishing needs do you have? None. I've got the same furniture for 40 years. My house is good. I have no kids messing it up. I don't need to do anything.
Yeah.
When you're talking to a 21-year-old college student who moves out of home and you say, what needs do you have? Well, everything, because I
have nothing.
I have nothing, right? So I think it definitely shapes it.
But that must be really, really challenging for a global kind of product-led organization like IKEA, where you've got so many versions of the many that you need to cater to, and all of their needs are different. You've got the different segments, you've got the different life stages. How has that changed, for example, your product development, the assortment choices that you make, your supply chain that you get up and running, etc.?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know if anybody's cracked it, right? I think all businesses are trying to find this balance of relevance but scale that's in there as well. Especially as the world becomes a lot more localized, right, nationalized, etc. as well. It's more like me and myself and my home, even like me versus my neighbor, we're different. So cater to my needs, even if their needs are different to me as well. And that poses big challenges for the businesses. I think our typical IKEA model, how we've done it for a long time, has been, you know, if you take something like a Billy bookcase, I can go into an 80-year-old person's home or a 20-year-old person's home or a family or whatever, or a couple, they'll have a Billy bookcase.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? The product itself, and it's the same thing when I used to work on Pampers before, right? No matter what country you live in, every baby needs to sleep. Every baby needs to use a diaper to contain what they need to. Every baby has the same basic human need, right?
Yeah.
It's the same as furniture. A lot of us have the basic human need. We need to sleep, we need to eat, we need to sit, we need to move, all those kind of things. And so I think it's a balance of designing products that are multi-purpose for multiple people. And the beautiful thing about IKEA is as you go into any store, right, it's all the different room displays, which looks in there. And, you know, if we have the Delft store here down the road or somewhere in the US or whatever it may be, within certain amount of kilometers around the store, we go in and find out how big the house is, how small it is, what it looks like. And then we go replicate it in the store and then put a Billy bookcase in there. Because it's like, this is your home in London, in Wembley. Billy is relevant. This is your Texas ranch. Billy is relevant.
Yeah.
But I'm going to show you in your context. I think when you get to a point of product design where you over-design, then you niche it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And I think this is the balance. That's the beauty of something like a bookcase. It's not complex, right?
Yeah.
It's like white walls, then shields, right? Yes, it's intelligent design, but it's not, you know, overly complex or specific for a specific person's need that can go across as well.
And so what if you, so I get that on the cupboards, right? The Billy cupboards. I think that makes a lot of sense. But when you get to the furniture items in the household that are maybe a little bit more kind of culture specific or taste specific, etc., as you've expanded, for example, into the US or into the Middle East or into Asia, etc., I'm assuming, but again, I could be wrong. I'm assuming that there are different expectations that a U.S. consumer has about aesthetics that you kind of have to decide, do I adjust to that or do I not adjust to that?
100%. Aesthetics, size.
Yeah. Right? Oh, yeah, exactly.
The average home in China versus the average home in Texas, they are not comparable.
Right? Yeah.
The size of a sofa that you have in the U.S., the size of a bed in the U.S. is not comparable to a bed in India, right? They're different. Yeah. Because of the space constraints, the number of people in the household and so forth. So, of course, you need to contextualize. But that's where I think, as a company, we have like a core, this is the universal, that goes everywhere. And then a percentage that's market-specific, market-relevant, what are the needs in that place? Now, how far do you go? You know, we've experimented with things like kimchi bowls and so forth. And you're like, specific, right?
Yeah, yeah.
How far do you want to go? We do know that the more relevant you go, the more localized you go, it does drive more appeal.
But
that's
the more
natural,
complexity,
right? Because
relevant,
but it creates so much more complexity
through
the system. So it's a matter of finding the balance. And it's not a pendulum swing of I'm super localized or I'm super globalized. It's that sort of balance in there that we need. It's like anything with life, right? It's all these balance of like, how do you find that as well? And it's a fine line to get there. And we constantly step one side or the other, right? But you're always jostling that part.
So, Joel, if I could just jump in.
Go ahead, Ian. Go ahead.
Fascinating what you're saying there. So looking at the consumer across all your global markets, would you say there's more differences than similarities all the other way around? Because I guess it would be a huge mistake to say that the Asian consumer has lots in common with an American consumer from what you were saying.
Of course. Look, the context is different, right? At the end of the day, I won't say everybody because of impoverished rates and so forth. Most people eat. Most people sleep. Right? Most people go to work. And so you have the needs in there. However, how you do that starts to become different in what you have, right? It's like, how do we recycle? How do we use the bin? How do we dispose waste? It's different based on even within a country, sometimes that's a bit different as well. Take the US. The US is not one country, right? I don't know if it's a political statement or not, but it's not one country. The US is basically Europe, right? With all the complexity in there. So how you look at Texas versus New York City couldn't be more different as well. And so it's definitely about contextualizing within that. Because we also have, if you look around the world, you have a lot of local players in different places. A lot of local businesses that are designing and catering for needs. And they don't care about global scale. They care about serving the needs within one place. And you compete with that. So it's the balance to actually strike in there as well.
Really fascinating. And I can imagine that IKEA is probably quite happy to have you because for example, your P&G experience, that whole balance between global and or global and local, that's an experience and an expertise that I guess IKEA can benefit now as it is on this international expansion drive.
Yeah, we've been on the expansion journey of IKEA for 2-3 decades, right?
Yeah,
it's been quite a journey to go there, but it's a journey because the world keeps changing and evolving.
Yeah,
and I think honestly, as an industry, we're learning so much over the last couple of decades about things like marketing and product design and development, what works. And like I talked about the attitudinal segmentation versus the life stage versus demographic. We're learning so much along the journey through making mistakes or not as well. So it's a balance. I think there's some core principles that will always hold. But the thing about this industry is you can never sit and be like, I know what I'm doing. Because the next day you don't.
You have
it wakes up, right?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Anything like, I'm not a necessarily super tech person. As soon as you go into a tech world, you're like, wow, I've got to relearn everything again, right?
Exactly.
And that's the next day and the next day.
So that's a nice jump then. Let's talk about channels. And so I think for a lot of, in any case, European people, when they think about IKEA, you know, aside from the fact that they think about products, but they also think about the big blue box, right? That big known destination where they love going to, and they spend their time. But we've seen IKEA increasingly experimenting and also rolling out in a more structured manner different store formats. Is there something that you can share about both the why have you done that, and also what lessons have you picked up along the way around what works, what doesn't work?
Look, the beautiful thing about IKEA is it's an experience, right? Again, as I said before, anybody you meet, they'll tell you about their experience, whether it's great or not.
They'll
tell you about their experience, right? And then you tell them to go call the customer hotline and whatever. Everybody has an IKEA experience and a relationship with. And I think that's what makes IKEA unique. That's one of the things that makes this unique versus many other companies as well, right? Because retail is retail. It's a store. It's a four walls. Yeah, it's a price point. It's whatever it may
be. You go to your picking and you go.
How do you humanize that and build a relationship with it? And I think so many people have grown up with that brand and have the experiences through there as well. And so if we were a digitally native born business, maybe you have less experience because we know a channel like online is it's much more functional, right? It's like, how cheap can I get it? How quick can I get it? How do I compare it? All of us as shoppers do it too, right? We have like five web pages open at the same time, try compare, and then whatever comes easier. When you're in a store, it's almost like you're a guest and you're experiencing through that. At the same time, IKEA is built on efficiency, right? We are a volume business. Our business model is very smart in terms of volume efficiency, and that's what enables us to actually be affordable and pass on lower prices to people that others can't. But we know through that over time, it's meant that we are further away from people, right? And I think when you look at a few decades ago, people are happy to drive an hour to go to you because they know it's a fun day out.
Yeah.
It's an experience they can get it. The kids are looking like my kids. They're like, how much ice cream can I eat and how many hot dogs can I eat? Well, it's the experience that's there. But over time, I think as people's lifestyles get busier, as life gets more complex, the convenience factor comes up as well. Then it's like, do I want to drive an hour to get there, right? And when it becomes a bit more functional as well. And so for us, it's been very much about how do we be where people are? And I think historically it was like people will come. These days, it's very much like businesses need to go.
I think
a few decades ago, businesses had a lot of power in terms of like there was fewer businesses, so you control a bit more. There's so many business, so much competition, and thankfully consumers have power. And that means that it forces us to get better. And it means that it forces us to get closer and actually bridge that gap to people as well. And so for us, we've gone through the massive omni-channel or multi-channel, whatever you want to call it now, different person, different terminology, journey of online, small stores, city centers, big areas, pickup points, etc. And really like any company, trialing it, right? Because you can conceptualize a lot of things, but you don't know until you do it. You don't figure out, well, how many people did I add to the business by opening this? What's my cost efficiency of doing it? What did that impact for the experience? What's the fulfillment process to get this store versus that or whatever it may be? And so we've been on a massive trial and error journey. And we've learned, we've opened, we've closed, we've opened, we've built. We're going through that process and we probably will continue to as well.
But the key thing is you've opened and you've learned. That's kind of the key cycle.
Sure. And in retail, you can't not learn.
Yeah.
Because you don't have the time to waste to bleed the P&L, right? It's like if it works, then boom. If not, then you go.
And close. As we all become more highly expectant on convenience in particular, what can you say about the role of the app in particular, both outside the store and in the store? Have you any interesting insights or experiences in the role of the app and how consumers use that?
Look, it's a touch point, right? That goes all the way through. And I think different touch points serve different needs and relationships within there as well. Obviously, to download an app, you have to go through a process. And you have to have an affinity to a brand. You don't just put something on your phone that just for the sake of it, right? It takes up space, takes up time, takes up memory, takes up whatever it may be. So obviously, therefore, it's about creating and bringing closeness to that, right? And understanding. And obviously, from a business, you get benefits from that. And many businesses will tell you, right, the more relationship you have, the more data you have, the more understanding they have, the more you can customize better, right? It's any kind of human relationship. Yeah. The more I know you, the better I can do for you. And I can serve your needs in that as well. And an app is a great way to do that, right? Now, is it as scalable as something like a .com web page? Obviously not, right? Because there's an extra process to go through. But it serves a need. And I think that's the key thing through all these channels, like apps online, a micro channel, you could even say, like app online, small store, big store, etc. They serve different needs that are complementary. If you're smart about it, how do you put them in a complementary ecosystem that serves their needs in a very efficient way as well?
So all incredibly interesting, fascinating, but as we said again before we started this conversation, all really complex. There's a lot of extra things that you need to kind of, I guess, consider, which makes retail as fun as it is.
Retail is detail, right?
Right now. Yeah, completely. One of the themes that we've clearly seen in particular in the Asian markets for some of the European players that have tried to move into Asia is this realization that actually your own channels, your own stores, in a demographic that your brand might not be known, doesn't work. You need to get onto the third-party platforms with all of the downsides that come with that. I know that IKEA has looked at that extensively in various parts of the world. Any conclusions, or are we still on the kind of the learning part of that?
It's a constant learning journey, right? I think as any brand, you want to hold things as close to yourself as you can.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons. But as you said, we also need to reach more
and
be where people are. And there's a big thing where a lot of people may not want to go to a branded website because they want to see a comparison across or an understanding. It's about being relevant to their situation and the need through there as well. So for sure, we're trying different things, right? I think we just announced another partnership in the US where we'll partner with another retailer and put our IKEA products in their stores as well. Similar to China with platforms, and we've done tons of different testing on it as well. But as you said, you open up to more, and that brings you open up to more benefit. You open up to more challenge in different ways.
Yeah, completely. And so is there anything you can say about the, again, the announcement with the US retailer? Is that a trial, or is that a new meeting point?
No, it's a new meeting point. I think it's rolling. It's a new meeting point that we announced that it's going through. And it's, again, a matter of we want to be where people are. And in the U.S. is a business which is not small, right? It's one of our top two businesses in the world. It's a big business. And yet our market share is very low. And the U.S. is a very big country and a lot of opportunity within there. And there's a lot of homes with a lot of needs that we can cater for within that in the society as well. But again, if you imagine the size of the U.S., it's a big country to drive across. I did it a couple of weeks ago, and it takes a long time to drive different parts of the states. And especially within a society that's very much like, I want things now and here and busy as well. You need to be where people are. And so we have big plans for the U.S. We'll continue to. But we will also, as we say, it is a new partnership agreement that moves. But it's a learning journey with everything. There we go.
What an exciting time to be, right? Because I think for those of us who have known and been passionate about IKEA for a long time, in my head, it's always been IKEA products in IKEA channels.
Yeah.
Whereas kind of both the other people's products in IKEA channels is something that you're experimenting with, but the IKEA products in somebody else's channels, some of us, for example, would have thought that they would never come. But it's tremendously exciting that that's happening right now.
Yeah, and I think there's a bigger notion, right, that we need to always rethink ourselves. And I think what makes IKEA phenomenal is we are consistent for the last 80 years as a business company. We know our culture values, we know our vision mission. We're not searching for a new vision or a mission. We've had it for the longest time. It's core to who we are and motivates us in what we do. How you operate and what you do evolves over time. Right, and that's where you need to be relevant. It's not why you exist or what you do, but how you do things, I think, continues to evolve within there as well. And I've always had this adage of, like, you should test yourself, you should disrupt yourself before someone else disrupts you, right? And so you've got to challenge your notions in that as well. And I think as a business, we will continue to challenge ourselves and continue to disrupt ourselves so that we can try and learn and figure it out. It's not about sitting around thinking and thinking and thinking and thinking, right? It's like, think enough, do, learn,
and
do.
Fascinating. Maybe let's jump to the kind of another big theme, which is, it's probably was a bigger theme, let's say 2-3 years ago than it is now, but I think it's still society wise a really big theme. Sustainability. Keen to see or to hear your perspectives on whether you've seen consumer sentiment on sustainability change and how you describe that. You know, are they still as committed as they are? Are they willing to pay extra for sustainability? Does the expectation lie with IKEA to do that? Let's start with that.
I think I can probably summarize it in one word, which is authenticity. I think if we look at sustainability for the last decade or two, right, it's gone through the motions, right, of any kind of like bigger movement that's there. And I think from a consumer standpoint, it's very much like it's a demand to be authentically sustainable and do it. Yes, as a consumer, I will do my part, but as a business, you need to do your part as well. And it's a balance that's there. And it's more around looking at it and saying, you know, like any business like ours, you look at, and it's good that we have things like CO2 emission targets, like many companies and countries do that it forces you to look at it and say, what is causing the CO2 emissions and what's contributing more or less or whatever it may be? And therefore, where do we focus and how do we make drastic change? And we're no exception to that. And we know there's a role that consumers have to play in making their things work, but there's probably an even bigger role that we need to play as businesses to actually step change within there as well. And it's more in our control, because I can't control a consumer, right? I can help them understand how they can live more sustainably or whatever it may be, and I can give them solutions that might help them to do that. But it's also within our four walls, in our backyard. We also need to figure out how to make that better too.
Yeah, and I guess if you look at the last few years, there are those organizations that have kind of gone on the sustainability journey to an extent at the pace that consumers expected and or the pace that the regulators expected.
Yeah.
My sense with IKEA is that at least a large part of that drive is also around who you are and what you see when you look in the mirror as an organization. It does feel quite purpose-led.
Well, I think the reality of it is, and it's just the right thing to do, right? And I think the challenge to the sustainability process is, I think a lot of companies, to be honest, looked at it and was like, it's a movement, how do we jump on it?
Yeah.
And when the movement dies, everyone jumps off. And you're like, but the need is still there, right? It's fundamentally there if you look at any of the data, the science, whatever it may be. And so for us, we look at it and say, look, does it drive consumer appeal and desire for IKEA? Yeah, sure. And do people perceive us as sustainable? Definitely, right? So it is an equity and it's something that we associate and we build with. But even without that, you want to be more sustainable. You want to have less of an impact. But I think, as you said, it's the balance of that and affordability as well.
Yeah.
Right? This whole thing of sustainability means I have to pay more. And yes, in some occasions. For consumers, sometimes they do. As a business, sometimes it does. It does cost more to be sustainable sometimes, right? Because you have to make certain choices. But the sweet spot is really in how do we do affordability and sustainability? How do we do it in a better way, right? It's like, can you give people home furnishing solutions like light globes or whatever it may be that are more sustainable and, by the way, save you money? Because when you hit that, then you can really drive what people want and what they need, right, in the short term and in the long term. And then you're catering for that, that will actually help it to be more sustainable in that as well.
Fascinating. I guess another theme in society's voice that has kind of risen and fallen similarly to an extent on sustainability is the whole diversity, equity, and inclusion theme, right? In particular, in the last 12, 18 months, we've seen in various parts of the world that really taking quite a push. I'm assuming the answer there is similar. How does IKEA deal with that ebbing and flowing of how important that is to consumers? Question number one. And question number two, how does IKEA deal with that when you both have to be relevant for European consumers, but also those consumers in Texas or in Singapore or wherever?
Well, if you look at the fundamental need underneath it, and there's so much around this topic, right? So I'm not going to do it justice, but everybody wants to feel included. Everyone wants to feel like they have a voice. Everyone wants to feel like they're contributing to. It doesn't matter if I'm male, female, race, gender, whatever it may be, right? I want to feel included and that I'm contributing to something. And that when you're engaging with me as a brand, that you're relevant and understand me. And I think that's just a human need that's there. And again, as D&I has come up over the last decade or two, I think that need has always been there. It's just that it's manifesting in certain ways these days and evolving that way as well. And so for us, going back to our core vision of being there for the many people, right? It doesn't matter who you are, we will be there for you. And I think that's actually, even if you talk about culture and values within IKEA as well and how we operate, we're big on inclusivity within, right? It's one of the reasons I drew me to IKEA. It doesn't matter if you're 20 years in the job or 1 year in the job. It doesn't matter if you have a great title or not. Actually, none of us at IKEA have fantastic titles. They're all And that's a signal of, it's not about position. It's about, you know, merit, who you are, what you bring, and what you can contribute to. And I think we live that internally very uniquely, I would say. That obviously has downsides in a way for different ways because but then obviously externally we live that as well. So they have to balance. I can't be inclusive in my marketing if I'm not inclusive in my people and culture way of working, right? They have to go hand in hand. And that's what I mean about authenticity within these spaces as well.
So I've been involved with IKEA for quite a long time, and I've dealt with a lot of other organizations. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably safe to say that, in my view in any case, the culture and identity and values within IKEA are significantly, for me anyway, more pronounced and unique than in most other organizations that I know of. And the titles thing that you referred to is a perfect example, right? Mm. The most senior people in IKEA will have titles whereby it is impossible to deduce what they do or how senior it is.
Yeah.
But that's part of what makes that identity so unique. Can I ask you to try, for somebody who has never been in an IKEA head office, what is it about the IKEA culture that is unique, that would surprise people if they walked into the building?
It's a good question. It's very normal. It's very, you know, I've worked at corporate companies, public FMCG before, and it's suit, tie, sit at a desk, you know who people are, you look at them and you know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
At IKEA, I guarantee if you walk into the building, you know, but if anybody walked in the building, they would not know who our CEO is.
Yep.
Right? Or CEO or CFO, whatever it may be. You wouldn't be able to tell at all. And I think that's one of the powerful things about it, is it's just very normalized in a way. It's anybody within there has the ability to have an opinion and to voice it or not. No matter, even if your job doesn't warrant your opinion, if you have an opinion, your voice is heard in that. And I think that's what makes it really powerful and unique and different to other businesses that would be as well. You know, I've worked for corporate American companies and it's not the same thing,
completely.
Right? It's a different setup completely. And I think that's what makes it powerful. And in the sense, then it makes it very people-centric. That's one of the reasons I joined IKEA. I've worked for very performance-driven companies, which are phenomenal. And there's a reason for that. And it's great. And I love it. IKEA is a phenomenally people-centric company. And now I think the balance is, how do you get the sweet spot of that, right?
Yeah.
Leverage your people to drive performance. But it's definitely on that people-centricity, because our vision and mission is not to be the number one home furnishing retailer in the world. It's to create a better everyday life for many people, right? And so it's why we do it, not necessarily to be the number one financial success, right? It's that finances drive and help, but we're not there to make money. We're there to serve people's needs, and we do that through making money.
And my sense is that there are a lot of organizations who talk that way, but don't necessarily live that
way.
Sure. Yeah, and I think IKEA is much closer to that.
Yeah, and I think we saw that 10 years ago when every company went after this purpose thing, right?
Yeah.
And everyone tried to like define the purpose, and they tried to make their purpose about saving the world, and it was like, really?
Yeah, exactly.
Really? Because I buy your products, and that's
not what I'm doing.
And that's the authenticity thing as well. Like, be true to why you exist and what you do, because you'll see through it straight away.
And so I think another really fascinating piece about IKEA linked to this, which as an outsider maybe isn't that visible, but is leadership. And my sense is that, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but that most of the leaders in IKEA are people not from the outside who have been successful, you know, for 10, 15, 20 years within IKEA. But equally, I don't know whether there's a lot of ex-IKEA people that have been successful elsewhere. Can you describe maybe a little bit what makes a great IKEA leader? Or is it just as simple as you know, living and breathing the values?
Look, I think as a business, what makes us unique as IKEA is our value chain. There's many things that make us unique, but that's one of the thing, right? Is we go all the way from the forest to the store to the home, right? And it's rare that you have a business that's integrated in that way through the franchise system that we have. And that creates a lot of value in that. Therefore, there's a lot of value in understanding that, right? It's a reason why, you know, for example, last year I took all of my team to factories in Poland, and we understood how a tree becomes a piece of furniture, right?
Yeah.
Because even if they're sitting in an office creating digital products, it's great and necessary to understand, well, how do we design the furniture and what do we do and how does that process, and having an empathy for that, right? When you spend time going through our supply chain with our suppliers and our own ecosystem, it just creates a massive empathy and an understanding for how does the business operate, how tricky is it, and what do we do? And it goes from the head to the heart, and that contextualized. And I think a good IKEA, a great IKEA leader understands that journey.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I think we don't operate as a business by ourselves anymore, right? 50 years ago, there was very few home furnishing companies. Now, I can't count how many there are,
yeah.
Right? And so there is also an element of constantly challenging yourself with what's happening on the outside. And when I joined 4 years ago, a lot of it was come in and help us a little bit, because tell us what's happening in other places, right? Bring that different knowledge and expertise to challenge the system a bit too. And I'm a firm believer in we should always act as if it's like our day zero, that we should always, even if you've been in the business for 35 years, constantly challenge yourself, like if I left and came back today, then what would I do differently? Or what would I do? And I think from a people standpoint, we're doing that. We're blending much more now value chain experience, like all the way across and working in different parts of mm-hmm. the company, the business, with outside of IKEA experience to come into that, to challenge the notion and help us to improve as well.
Yeah. Excellent. I'm conscious that I think we've got about 5 minutes left. It is the middle of 2025. We cannot have a conversation without talking about artificial intelligence. Mm. So let's kind of take that off as well. How relevant is, and let's kind of pull the net wider, how relevant is artificial intelligence right now in what you do for and with IKEA? And talk me through how you see that accelerating or slowing down in the next couple of years.
I think it's every day is a new day. Right, the acceleration is unstoppable in a way as well, right? That's going there. And it's a little bit like science in a way, where every couple of months you figure out something new and it continues to evolve as well. For us, it's super relevant. Like any business, it's relevant. It can't not be. The thing with AI, though, is what do we know and what do we not know? And like any business, we trial, we play, we do. And as insights function as well within, obviously we do it, because there's areas where it makes you more efficient,
mm-hmm.
makes you smarter, makes you more capable. But at the same time, it's also, I think, important to have your stance on what is your position around it, you know? Anything with technology, like a bridge back to your sustainability discussion before, AI and sustainability are not separate topics. There's implications, right, through how we do it as well and what we do. There's ethics and responsibility, how you do it. How do you hold yourself to a higher standard than others would? Because you should and you can. So for us, obviously super relevant from all the way through how we internally operate to how we externally operate. But with careful consideration. And I think it's the thing about being a business like IKEA, we're not going to rush into something because it's the new fad or the new cool thing to do. We're going to look at it. When you're a company that's been built for 80 years, you don't just flip overnight, right? You don't need to flip overnight. You take your time to look at it and say, what's the implication? How do we work through this? What do we need to do? Do we need to be the first mover on AI, or can we be the second, third, or fourth, right? Because then we can learn from others, mitigate the risk, and do the right thing. Because it goes back to the point, how do you just do the right thing for people?
So wisdom and serenity comes both with a good self-image and age and maturity.
Yeah, and never letting technology take over why you exist and help you to forget why you exist and what you do, right? Because you can easily get caught up in it. And yes, there's amazing stuff that you can do and you can drive efficiency with, and we are, of course, through supply chain, through data, through everything. But it's a tool. It's not a reason for existence. It's a tool that enables you. So
nice. Right. We could keep talking for hours. We're not going to. So let's close off with four quick questions.
Boom.
Number one, what are you most proud of?
IKEA.
Yeah.
Let me just do the right thing.
What are you most worried about?
Not knowing. Every day is a new day. The world constantly changes. The business constantly changes. And every day is a day to relearn, right? So what's next? What news do we wake up to tomorrow? And how do we adapt?
Of all the things potentially over the horizon, what are you most excited about?
The potential for change at the same time. Disruption equals opportunity if you harness it in the right way. and you can let the world dictate what you do, or you can be part of the change and drive it forward. And that's exciting to take that position.
Okay. Final question. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give to your wide-eyed 22-year-old self?
Go become a professional football player and retire by 25. Go and have experience.
Okay. Any specific experience?
Look, I think when you're 21, your whole thing is, how do I progress as fast as I can and do what I need to, go on as vertical as much as I can. I've had the privilege of working across the world for nearly 20 years now in different parts. And there is so much power in experience. Learning things you don't know, jumping off the proverbial cliff and just being, you know, I don't know how to do this, but I'm going to do it and I'm going to figure it out, and being okay with that. And then knowing that your career is a marathon, not a sprint. And a marathon has many stages as part of it, and it's learning through that as well.
Awesome.
That's been a fantastic conversation. It's just been really, really fascinating. So thank you very much, Adhild, for leading the conversation. And Joel, it's been amazing. Thank you. And I just wanted to sort of reiterate everything you've said about the power of the brand. I mean, at this year's World Retail Congress, we consulted a global consumer database, live database, and said, which retailer, which brand do consumers think anywhere in the world is the most trusted, is the most innovative, suits people's needs? And as you probably know, IKEA were presented with the award, which is quite something, because as you said, it's an 80-year-old brand to stay relevant and to deliver for consumers anywhere in the world as you are operating is quite something. So I think that really speaks to everything you've touched on in this conversation. So I really want to thank you, Joel, but thank you both for leading, I think, what's been a terrific episode of the World Retail Podcast. Thank you.
Wonderful. Joel, thank you for being here. Thanks very much. Have a good day.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you for listening to this episode of the World Retail Podcast, part of our special series, The Consumer, brought to you in partnership with Deloitte. We hope today's conversation gave you valuable insights into how the consumer is evolving and what this means for your future strategy. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to leave us a review. It really helps others find the show. To stay up to date with the latest from the World Retail Congress and to access more exclusive content, visit us at www.worldretailcongress.com and follow us on LinkedIn. We'll be back soon with more thought-provoking discussions from the front lines of retail. Until then, thanks for listening.